One of the wonderful things about coming to speak at events like this is you get such gracious introductions. And as I said, unfortunately, people say that they hear me on the radio and on television, but it's only when the bottom has fallen out of something or other and we need to speak. And far too often, it has become about not only Christians in the Middle East, but also ethnic minorities and people who tend to suffer and become at the receiving end of intolerable aggression and brutality. It is a pleasure to be here. I feel very much out of my depth being in such an academic environment, but also looking out in the audience and seeing many friends who I know probably know much more about this than I will. And so I don't come to you as a political analyst or as a political specialist. I come to you as a minister of religion, a pastor, a shepherd, and to present our view of the world today within Egypt and how we should be addressing the various things that are happening there. Just a little bit about the Coptic Church, and many of you may not understand what Coptic means. Coptic just means Egyptian. And it's very similar to Greek Orthodox or Russian Orthodox, but Coptic just means Egyptian Orthodox. And I usually go to great lengths to explain this because I was once driving to one of our parishes and stopped to refuel my car. And gruffly dressed gentleman, the rucksack and the sign, looked at me and said, good morning, Padre. And I said, good morning. He said, yes, what church do you belong to? And it was far too early in the morning to go through the whole Greek, Russian, Serbian paradigm. So I said, I'm Egyptian Orthodox. He said, oh, so you're Coptic. Turned out he was a lapsed theologian. And since then, I don't take shortcuts. So the church has been in Egypt since the first century. And since then, it has been a witness to peace and to a peaceful existence. Of course, as we all know, at the beginning of 2011, the world changed significantly in Egypt. And suddenly, a rule, a regime, an administration that had been there for decades ceased to be there. Of course, we, as the church, were accused at the time of not supporting the revolution, of not supporting the uprising, of having been far too stood back from what was happening. And of course, that came from our knowledge of what was about to happen. There was a great enthusiasm, there was a great positive vibe, and it was very unexpected that we would find ourselves in that position in Egypt. But we also knew, as well as many others, that the reservation we had was because of experience. There had been no investment in the past decades into a succession of power, into training political ability, or a political source or presence that could possibly step into this gap that had suddenly emerged. And what was even more alarming was that there was a more radical presence that was ready to jump into that gap, which it did. And so, even for myself, was my own personal skepticism. I was hoping that I was going to be very wrong. And we went into that time with an understanding that this was a new start. There were going to be free and fair elections. There were going to be candidates. There were going to be people who would represent Egyptians, not just a faction, but Egyptians as a whole. And those people, as candidates, would then stand, and the Egyptian people would have their say through an election. Of course, there was a problem. There was a problem that for the previous decades, there was no intentional investment into the creation of social cohesion or a national identity. And people had retracted into their religious identity. A numeric majority Muslim population was there, between 85 and 90%, with a numeric minority of Christians. Of course, as Christians in Egypt, we don't consider ourselves as a minority, because indigenous people have been there since the beginning. But of course, doubtlessly, it is a numeric minority. There was a comment by one of the Muslim Brotherhood leadership, even before the uprising, when asked after the bombing of a church in Alexandria, "So, who do you feel closer to, a Coptic Christian Egyptian or an Indonesian Muslim?" And his response was that because of the concept of Ummah, the nation of Islam, that he felt closer to the Indonesian Muslim. And that's where Egypt was. There was a short-lived sense of national identity and national pride. But with the wrong kind of leadership, the leadership that then became very self-interested and became interested only a sector of the society, this was propagated. Unfortunately, we then had a democratically elected president, and by all means, he was democratically elected, referring to a certain sector of the community as his people and those of his tribe. Not the whole of the Egyptian people, but only a very small sector. And that was unfortunately the beginning of what was seen to be a very quick power grab, a self-interest, and a skewed representation. Of course, we then saw a galvanization of the community, whether it was through public protest or a public vote of no confidence. The world was so preoccupied with the term coup. Was it a coup? Was it not a coup? Of course, the word coup means different things to different people, and the debate was particularly sparked by the United States because of its grant money that was dependent on whether an uprising was a coup or not. We were thankful to the British government, Her Majesty's government here, that actually didn't use the word coup. But whatever it was the voice of a vast majority of people. Now, of course, they weren't all Christians, because if they were all Christians, then we're saying that there is a huge number, some saying up to 30 million Christians who walk the street. And of course, we know that there weren't that number. This was an uprising of Egyptians, young, old, Christian, Muslim, religious, secular, men, women. It was a public voice. The Egyptian people had spoken. That wasn't the church. It wasn't Al-Azhar. It was the people. And of course, this then led to a series of incidents. There was, of course, the demonstration at Rabaa al-Adawiyya. There was the tragic death of hundreds that came after that with the clearing of that demonstration. And I must say that any loss of life is tragic. God did not create Christians different to Muslims, different to atheists. Every life is sacred and every life is sanctified. And the loss of every life brings pain to mothers, wives, children, communities equally, whatever community they belong to. The problem is, in direct reaction to the clearing of that demonstration, we had the unprecedented attacks on 50 churches and 50 places of Christian ministry throughout Egypt, orchestrated within a 48-hour period. Now, I say orchestrated because when I was interviewed at the time, I said that the best case scenario was that they were orchestrated. Worst case scenario was this was the public sentiment that existed below a very, very thin veneer. And I don't think that was the case. What happened after that changed not only the course of history of Egypt, but of the Middle East and of the world. You see, for some people, they would have said that this was done to create a spiral of anger and violence where Christians would retaliate against Muslims, get a spiral of violence there and destruction, and therefore have a failed state, which would then have had a ripple effect and would have changed the situation in Egypt and the Middle East. The non-retaliatory reaction, the non-violent reaction, the forgiving reaction was that which actually not only shocked Egypt but shocked the world. We had Muslim presenters come on Egyptian television saying, react, be angry, shout, scream. For decades, Christians had been accused of being West sympathizers and traitors. They had been accused of having weapons stores in their churches and monasteries. Surely this would have been the time to bring them out. At the time when people demonstrating for the removed president were asking for foreign intervention in Egypt, Christians who had been attacked actually said, this is the price we're paying for a transition. It's a stage and will pass. We are Egyptians and we solve our problems internally. As we've seen in the Middle East, external solutions rarely, if ever, work. And it had to be an internal solution. During that time, the time that the world so poetically called the Arab Spring, became very challenging. Even in the West here, there is no single model of democracy. Democracy looks very different here in Britain, to the United States, to France, to Germany, to other states. We are even seeing, through now coalition governments, democracy looking very different even within our own nation. But we wanted to export this democratic ideal model to the Middle East and to Egypt. What is important is this. Democracy is a means to an end, not an end in itself. It is not a benchmark of civilization. It is not what people have to suddenly give them a badge of honor that they have transitioned into a more civilized people. Democracy is a means that provides representation, stability, and security. And if whatever model is demonstrated does not do that, then it has failed. Democracy also needs two very important components. It needs viable candidates with clear agenda and platforms, and then it needs an informed choice by the electorate. And I think we saw that in a lot of ways, those weren't always available. The church's role in this is not to be partisan. It is not to pick one party or another. The church, faith, in my opinion, must always remain as a moral compass to politicians and to administrations. Because power will change, administrations will change, governments will change. But we as people of religion must always be there to be reconcilers, to be bringers of peace. When I spoke in Scotland just before the referendum, this is a point I made to the Church of Scotland General Assembly. Whether it's in Scotland or in Egypt or anywhere else, we must have that presence of reconciliation that we are called to have as people of religion and as people of faith. We saw that in August of 2013 when those churches were attacked, because let's face it, religion now is presented as a problem rather than a solution. This morning at the Foreign Commonwealth Office launch of its new report on human rights, I made a point to the minister that issues of gender, sexuality, issues to do with women, children, vulnerable adults, have become issues of positive engagement, ensuring the rights of these people. Yet religion and freedom of religion has become almost a problem that must be dealt with. And so it is a very different approach to how we view it. As a Christian, I feel that my role is to reconcile. As a church, I feel that my role is to reconcile and to encourage people to be good, proactive citizens of whatever state they belong to, abiding by law, but are also abiding by God's law of peace. You see, we saw something horrific in Libya a few weeks ago. And I think that changed many things in our world today. We have seen through the execution of those innocent men in Libya the worst and the best of humanity. We've seen the worst in brutality, in such a polarization where I could actually look at another person and refuse to see that person's humanity. Where I look at that person and see that person as a commodity, to be traded, to be bartered, to be made an example of, to be used as a political tool. Because that is the only way that we could explain what happened to these people. As people of religion across all religions, and speaking of myself as a Christian, Christianity first and foremost, we believe in the sanctity of life. That God created us all equal, and equally important, and equally accountable. You see, the human rights that we speak about at the moment are not the creation of international charters. They are God-given, and they are merely enshrined by and protected by civil, national, international law. We didn't create these rights. God created us with these rights. And so therefore we must safeguard them for one another. We must come out of our tribal approach to human rights. There is no way that I could possibly sit comfortably thinking that I have advocated for my people and my people are safe and sound, yet Yazidis, atheists, Shiites, Sunnis, Buddhists, Sikhs, anyone could possibly be victimized and marginalized by my side. That would really be the most unchristian thing I could possibly do. I cannot place my life and the life of my flock above the lives of others. And that is our role. It's very easy to be dragged into the political reality of our nation states. And let's face it, in Egypt, all of this democracy stuff is very new. It's new to government, it's new to church, it's new to Al-Azhar, it's new to people. And it's going to take us a long time to figure out what to really do with it. It's going to take us time to understand how we fit into that picture. No nation can be pushed into a mold. It must wrestle with itself until it is comfortable within that new model. And so there will be times when the church is accused of being too close or too far from the administration. standing beside or rejecting the administration. The administration is going to be accused of spending too much time at Al-Azhar or in the cathedral. Christians are going to be seen as being too cliquey within their own community, and Muslims could be seen as being too exclusive in theirs. At the end of the day, there is only one way ahead in these communities. And as religious institutions, as ministers, as religious societies, we need to rise above that and challenge that. Neither politics nor religion exist in a vacuum. And we would be naive to think that they do not influence each other. But they should not be each other's agents. Of course, there is a cross-interaction at times. And of course, there is going to be, at a time, we think we should do one thing and maybe get it wrong. But there needs to be a leeway where we don't look at every person with a sense of waiting for that person to make a mistake, being critical. One thing happened in the church that was very, very important during this period. And it was quite striking, the effect that it had. We had Pope Shenouda. The late Pope Shenouda had been Pope for 40 years, passing away at the same time as the post-uprising administration was removed. And suddenly there was a transition of power, a transition of authority, a transition of leadership. People saw a model within the transparency in the church and saw the same reactions within political life. And thankfully, and as we would all expect, of course, religion would come out on top. Being an ideological presence, being a presence of spirituality and spiritual engagement, being a presence of morality and moral understanding. People saw a transition of leadership in the church and a transition of leadership in the state, and saw that the meaning of power and authority in both was very different. And that captured people's imaginations. Some actually made jokes that the locum tenens, the interim patriarch, would be good to take over Egypt for a while until the president was elected. But within that, there was an understanding that religion needs to take the higher ground and not be dragged into the rough and tumble of politics that not only exists in Egypt, but exists everywhere. There is a confusion, however. There's a confusion between political activity and advocacy. Of course, I would get my definition from the Oxford Dictionary, being here. But political activity, as is stated, is the art or science of government or governing, especially of a political entity, such as a nation, administration, and the control of its internal and external affairs. That is the life of the world of politics. Whereas advocacy is the public support for or recommendation of a particular cause or policy. So, if the church does advocacy, that is not politics. If we stand up for the marginalized, for the persecuted, that is not politics. That is our role. If we look at the ethos of Christianity, it is following the message of Christ himself, who, in the Gospel of St. Luke, speaks of a prophecy relates to him and says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because I have been anointed to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, and set at liberty those oppressed. And so it is our role as Christians to follow in those footsteps. It doesn't say anything about political rule, because our Lord also said that we should give to God what is God's and to Caesar what is Caesar's. A recognition of that difference. But in calling people to account for abuses against people and against their right to exist and their right to believe and even their right not to believe, that is what we are called to do. As a church, we must stand for issues such as forgiveness, reconciliation, the protection of every individual, every vulnerable individual. And it is time for us to look at all of that and work collaboratively. There is so much energy that is wasted on different camps and different tribes trying to secure their own. In Egypt, it could be very easy, as it could be here, as anywhere else, to have lobbies for Christians and Muslims and women and children and vulnerable adults and the disabled. And the list can go on. Yet, what a world it would be if we would just advocate for human rights. Voltaire had his famous quote saying that, "I may not agree with what you say, but I will support you even unto death and your right to say it." Are we in a position to do that? Can we really do that? There is a responsibility on us as religious institutions, as religious leaders, to call people to account on these ideals. These ideals are not only in textbooks, but they must be lived. There is, of course, a problem, twofold. There is a problem now in the Middle East, where a group such as IS, Daesh, whatever you would like to call them or they call themselves, using religious texts to justify what they do. Now, that's a problem for me, because every Muslim I know is completely at odds with and rejects what is happening. And so the problem we have here is this. That leadership can only come from within Islam and Islamic leaders. It can only come by people within Islam who are authorities challenging these texts, either saying, actually, they don't exist, and so therefore you've got a wrong understanding, or defining a nuanced understanding of how to not only reflect upon, but to apply these verses. It was interesting to see President Sisi at Al-Azhar telling the clerics there, and Al-Azhar being the foremost Islamic institution in the world in terms of Islamic teaching, challenging them to look at this. It could only come from someone like him, because he is not only a Muslim, but he seemed to be a devout Muslim. And that change and challenge in teaching cannot come from anyone or anywhere except a place of Islamic teaching. But there is also a responsibility upon our shoulders, being on the receiving end, as we have been, of the application of this kind of marginalization. We must not let our people fall into a mental state of victimhood. And what we have seen over the past years, months, and recently weeks, is that the church's reaction and Christian reactions to what has happened has been one of incredible resilience. In my statement of very early this year, when there was an attack on Mosul, I warned of this caliphate model being replicated throughout the region if it wasn't challenged. And we have seen that happen. But having said that, after these men were killed in Libya, I, as well as many of the people in my own church and other churches, have said that we forgive. We forgive, not the act, because the act is brutal and against humanity as a whole. But we forgive the perpetrators. And we pray that perpetrators see the sanctity of life of every person. As I said, I'm not a politician. I was being interviewed on a particular program, and I was asked my view of what would happen, and I gave this concept of forgiveness. And the response was, Your Grace, but isn't that a very ideal view of life? And my reaction then would be, as is now, it would be very alarming if I, as a Christian minister, as a bishop in the church, do not only have, but try to live by and teach ideals. That is our role. Our role is not to take the place of politicians. Our role is not to meddle in public policy. Our role is to present ideals, to live ideals, to be a moral compass when decisions are made, to applaud things that are done well, but then to critically analyze things that are maybe contradictory to what we believe, and present an alternative, positive model that can work not only for our benefit, but for the benefit of a state, for the benefit of humanity, and for the benefit of the world that we all share so closely today. Because one thing that happens here will interact everywhere else in the world. And what I do with my congregation and my people, whether it be here or in Egypt or anywhere, is going to impact others. So that is my challenge. My challenge is one voice for all. A concerted, choreographed, prepared, unified voice that says that every life is sacred and says that we have a responsibility to protect our people and our world from evil that will one day marginalize and alienate all of us if we don't challenge it today. Thank you.